This world, human beings, often rely on someone else to have the right timing, or perhaps to have the right sense of timing, or perhaps to have the right sense of time whatsoever. Many different ways that can be applied. It can be applied in the sense of musical timing. You're playing with a band. You need to make sure that everyone is in rhythm. You need to make sure that they know when to come in, when to fade out, all of those different things. Or in sports, you need to make sure you can time your plays correctly. If you're in a theater production, when you're supposed to come on stage, when you're supposed to go off stage, when your line is not. There's all types of situations. Or maybe most specifically and importantly, and sometimes it's mundane, but it really affects people, you set a time to meet or to go somewhere or to start an event, and you're waiting and hoping that that person will be on time, right? We're always relying in many ways for other people to have the right sense of timing. And a lot of times, I'm sure as you've experienced by now, either the other person or you do not have a good sense of timing at times. But what we're going to learn this morning is that God's timing is always perfect. God's timing is always perfect. So title for our lesson today is God's Perfect Timing. If you'll recall, a famine has come upon the land of Egypt. And as we'll see, not just the land of Egypt, but really the entire surrounding area of the ancient Near East. And we've been following Joseph, and we'll continue to follow him. But before we do, we jump into his family, who we've not seen for some time. We last saw them during this series back when Joseph was 17 years old, and his brothers hated him. They threw him into a pit. They sold him into slavery, and that was the last they ever saw of him. That was the last he ever saw of them. Now, if you took any time to read the next chapter, there's a story regarding Judah and Tamar that kind of shows you the sin and the sorry state of Jacob's family at this point. And that's really all we get to know. We hear about that story, and then we've been following Joseph this whole time. Well, now we come back to Joseph's family. So we're going to have our first point we're going to come to is this: Jacob's informed command. Jacob's informed command. Now, verse 1. Now Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt. And Jacob said to his sons, "Why are you staring at one another?" He said, "Behold, I have heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us from that place so that we may live and not die." Now, I don't know. Surely you've experienced something like what Jacob just says to his sons. There's a famine. There's no food. And his 11 sons are all sitting around being like, "What do we do? I don't know what we're going to do. There's no food. What are we going to do?" And Jacob's like, "Why are you staring at each other? Do something." And he's like, "I heard that there's food in Egypt, so go to Egypt." And also notice that he says that we may live and not die. And this is something that is hard for us to comprehend because, well, we just celebrated it. We live in America. 250-year anniversary. And as part of this country, we get to experience so many blessings. And one of those blessings is we can have all the food we want. As long as we have money for it. But if you want something to eat, you go to the grocery store, you go to a restaurant, you buy the ingredients to make it yourself if you want to do that. There's all kinds of ways to eat food, and there's all kinds of food to eat, and there's an abundance of any and all of those different types of foods. But you need to realize that all of that food comes from somewhere. All of that food is grown, maintained, nurtured, cared for, protected. And if something bad happens to those sources, the farms, the cattle on it, the plants on it, or anything that's being imported from other countries, something bad happens to those plants. If something bad happens to those animals and they're all gone, goodbye abundance. Not only goodbye abundance, goodbye food at all. And if you've been hungry for any stretch of time, or if you've done any type of fasting for any stretch of time, the sensation of hunger is unlike any other type of sensation you can have. It's awful. And it does get so bad if you don't eat for a long enough period of time that first of all, you feel terrible, and then second of all, inevitably, you die if you don't have food. And normally, what do you do to solve that? Well, here, we just go find some food. But here, Jacob is telling his sons, look, we're going to die if we don't do something about this. I heard that there's grain in Egypt. Go get it before we die. That's the severity of the situation here. This isn't just like, oh, let's go on a trip. You know, you guys, I heard there's some grain. There's some nice grain there. Here's some money. Go get it. No, he's like, we're going to die if you don't go now. That's what's going on here. So verse 3, then 10 brothers of Joseph went down to buy grain from Egypt. But Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, I am afraid that harm may befall him. Now, we haven't talked a whole lot about Benjamin, and when I was growing up and I experienced this story, I always saw, you know, the pictures for it and envisioned in my mind that, you know, Benjamin was like, you know, 10 or 11 or 12 years old, and then all of the brothers. No, Joseph has been in Egypt for about 20 years, so Benjamin is at least 20 years old, if not older. So this isn't a situation where Jacob is like, oh, he's just a kid. No, this is something much more significant. And hopefully if you think about it, you'll recognize why. Because Benjamin is the other son of who? Of Jacob, yes. But of which wife? Close. Starts with an R. Rachel. Rachel was the favored wife. Joseph was the oldest son of Rachel. Benjamin was the other son of Rachel. And as far as Jacob is concerned, Joseph is dead. Benjamin is all he has left because Rachel is also dead. In fact, turn with me real quick to Genesis 35. This tells us the story of Benjamin's birth. Genesis 35, verse 16. So Jacob and his family, they're traveling. Verse 16, then they journeyed from Bethel, and when there was still some distance to go to Ephrath, Rachel began to give birth, and she suffered severe labor. When she was in severe labor, the midwife said to her, do not fear, for now you have another son. And it came about as her soul was departing, for she died. So pause right there. So whatever the situation is, Rachel's going to die as soon as she gives birth to Benjamin. And so something terrible has happened. So, for she died, that she named him Ben-Oni, meaning son of my pain or son of my sorrow. And that was typical of what you would tend to do when you named children, is you would give them a name that signified something about the circumstances surrounding their birth or surrounding your hope for them. And Rachel, in her moment of pain and in her moment of imminent death, calls him son of my pain. And then it says, but his father called him Benjamin. So after she passes, he, instead of calling him Ben-Oni, son of my pain, calls him Benjamin, which means son of my right hand. Benjamin is very precious to Jacob. So he doesn't want any harm to befall him. Verse 5, so the sons of Israel came to buy grain among those who were coming, for the famine was in the land of Canaan also. And one more point I want to make about the famine. Well, actually, a point I want to make about what God is doing here. We know at the ultimate goal here, because we know the story of Joseph, is that the family is going to move to Egypt, right? And this is one thing where we may be going like, why is God doing this way? Why doesn't he just like come to all the family members in a dream and say, hey, go to Egypt? Or why does he even do the famine in the first place? Like, why does he orchestrate the events in such a way where all of these things are happening? And, well, unfortunately, I don't have the answers for you. Just the questions. But I do have what I believe is two reasons why God is... We don't know why he did it this way, but we do know two reasons for his end goal, what he wants out of this whole situation. First of all, as we know, Jacob's family is in a sorry state, as we saw earlier. They hated Joseph. They didn't respect God's dreams to Joseph. They did not respect life because they slaughtered the Shechemites. They didn't respect their father because one of them slept with his concubine. They were not good men. And for God to, and for this family to continue to exist in this state is not going to bode well, because God may need to bring judgment upon them if they continue in all of this sin. So one of the things that's definitely happening here is when they come to Joseph, then there's going to have to be reconciliation. There's going to have to be, and there's also going to have to be a recognition of who God is and what he's doing, that he needs to be honored. And they're not willing to do that right now because they've got everything they need in Canaan. They've got their flocks, they've got their families. So they're good. They don't need to deal with God. They don't need to worry about him. They've got their own lives going on. So God sends a famine. And that should be by way of application to us, something you should bear in mind. You will never be able to keep God from putting you where he wants you. Ever. If you're like, nope, not going to do it. His brothers were like, nope, we don't care about God. We don't care about what we did to our brother. Famine. Everywhere. You have to go somewhere. You have to move. Otherwise, you're going to die. God can do what he wants. And if you think that you can resist his will, if you think that you can do something that's going to thwart his plans, if you think that you know what you're supposed to be doing and you're refusing to do it and you're like, there's no way I'm going to do this thing, oh, God will humble you. He can humble you at any moment, because that's what he does here. But there's a second reason why God is doing this. Turn with me to Genesis 15. Genesis 15, verse 12. This is where we are with Abraham, the grandfather of Jacob, the great-grandfather of Joseph and the brothers. Genesis 15, verse 12. Now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. And God said to Abram, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You will be buried at a good old age. Then in the fourth generation they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. There's a second reason why God is doing this. It's not just for the restoration of this family. It's because he is going to use the eventual nation of Israel as his sword of justice upon sinners. And in order for that to happen, they need to move to a land where they can prosper and flourish and grow and multiply without any worry for danger. Because understand, Joseph is in a prime position, as we're about to see. He's the second in command. He has control over anything and everything he wants. So as long as he is alive, and if his family comes to Egypt, they're protected. They're safe from any kind of danger, from anyone who would want to hurt them, harm them, steal from them, anything. And so God has set things up such that Joseph will show favor to his family so that his family will be able to be protected for generations, so that then they will come out of Egypt to be a sword of justice. That's the long-term goal for why God is doing this. And all of that, it's not come to fruition yet. It's just an old man and his sons who need some food. It's crazy how God works. So that was Jacob's informed command. Now we come to Joseph's disguised deposition. Joseph's disguised deposition. Verse 6. Now, Joseph was the ruler over the land. He was the one who sold to all the peoples of the land. And if you'll recall, what has Joseph been doing? Well, for 7 years, he has been the architect, the engineer, and the enforcer, and the driving leader, the driving visionary of this massive project in Egypt to take a fifth of all of the food that they're able to gather during 7 years of abundance, store it safely, keep it safely, make sure that everyone who normally in times of abundance is going to gorge themselves and want to like be very extravagant with all the abundance go, no, we need to save this for later. I mean, understand, if you're an Egyptian and you believe in, you know, the gods, you don't believe in the God, and this guy, Pharaoh, tells you, hey, there's gonna be 7 years of abundance and then 7 years of famine, and you're like, really? Like, we don't know who Yahweh is. Who's that? And they're like, you want to do what now with our food that we produced? You want to take how much of it? And then you're going to store it and not, you're, for how long? For 7 years? Joseph has a lot on his plate for an entire country. And yet apparently he's managed to make it happen because now Egypt is the savior of that area of the world because they're all coming to them for food. It says, and Joseph's brothers came and bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. And here we go. Joseph's dreams have been fulfilled in this moment. From the very beginning, when he first saw that dream of the wheat stalks, when he first saw that dream of the sun, the moon, and the stars bowing down to him, and it just happens. They have no idea who he is, as it's going to say. I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's actually read it. When Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he disguised himself to them and spoke to them harshly. And he said to them, where have you come from? And they said, from the land of Canaan, to buy food. But Joseph had recognized his brothers, although they did not recognize him. So how did Joseph disguise himself? Well, maybe he didn't have to do a whole lot of disguising. Maybe he disguised his voice a little bit. But again, 20 years have passed. So he probably looks very different from when he did when he was 17. Who knows? Maybe he, you know, had a change of clothes, maybe some makeup. I don't know. But whatever it is, he disguised himself. They didn't recognize him. And then we come to verse 9. Joseph remembered the dreams which he had about them and said to them, you are spies. You have come to look at the undefended parts of our land. We'll talk about that in a second. First, Joseph knew about that dream, as we've talked about. He remembered that dream. He trusted God that his life was in God's hands and God was going to do with him what he wanted. He's been faithful this whole time. You've seen how righteous he's been throughout all of these chapters that we've observed. And in this moment where he's just being responsible, managing this country, managing the grain to try to provide for people to keep them alive from suffering, his brothers show up. Can you imagine what that must have been like? You haven't seen these men for 20 years. The last time you saw them, you were begging and pleading for your life. You were pleading for them not to sell you away from your family, away from your father, to go who knows where, and they didn't care. They wanted more than anything to be rid of you. And that was the last you ever saw of them. And then suddenly, you are the second in command of a world power at that time. And those same men come to you and bow to the ground asking you for food. Can you imagine the power complex you would be tempted to feel in that moment? I'll bet Joseph felt it. And initially with his harsh response, where he's like, where have you come from? You are spies. You might think that maybe he's trying to get back at them a little bit. As we'll see, that's actually not the case. See, the reason why we're told Joseph remembered the dreams which he had about them is because Joseph goes, this is why I'm here. This is what those dreams were for. This wasn't just a dream that was going to tell me, oh, they're going to bow down to me. Whoop-de-doo. It was like, oh, they're coming to me because they need food. My family needs food. My father needs food. Where's my other brother? My other brother needs food. This is why I'm here. God has been preparing me this whole time. With all the suffering that I've gone through, he's prepared me for this moment to provide for my family, to take care of them. So a plan hatches in his mind. So let's continue with verse 9. He said to them, you are spies. You have come to look at the undefended parts of our land. Now, Joseph knows who his brothers are. It says he recognized them. And he knows that they're not spies. Was this a righteous thing to do? Moses does not comment. I think Joseph's character is such that whatever the context of how he interacts with them, because we're not told everything he says, because later in chapter 43, the brothers tell Jacob, hey, he asked us these questions and he talked to us about this. There's more to this conversation. So I believe that Joseph's character is such that whatever the full context, he acted righteously. But regardless, don't try this at home. We'll just go with that. So what is Joseph's ploy, though? Joseph's ploy is to get all the information that he can from them. By this point, because he's been running a country for 7 years, he knows how people tick. Accuse them of wrongdoing, and they will go above and beyond to defend themselves, usually oversharing information about themselves to demonstrate their own righteousness. And so they respond to him. They said to him, no, my lord, but your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants are not spies. I'll bet he's like, yeah, right. Honest men. Yet he said to them, no, but you have come to look at the undefended parts of our land. But they said, your servants are 12 brothers in all, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the youngest is with our father today, and one is no longer alive. Joseph said to them, it is as I said to you, you are spies. By this you will be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you that he may get your brother while you remain confined, that your words may be tested, whether there is truth in you. But if not, by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies. So he put them all together in prison for 3 days. Why? Well, first, they definitely believe that Joseph is dead by this point. So even though they're not telling the truth, they never told the truth about what happened to Joseph, it's clear that they believe he's dead now. As we'll see, Reuben says something about the reckoning for his blood. So they figured that once they sold him off, he eventually died, and he wasn't going to make it as a slave. So it's not necessarily that they're lying here, but Joseph knows that he's not dead. But why does he want them to bring him Benjamin? Why does he want to do that? Well, I think the most obvious one is, well, he wants to see him. He's the younger brother, the one that didn't sell him into slavery. He wants to see him again. And also perhaps he thinks that because he knows how much Jacob cared about and was probably very protective and very close to him, Joseph, that maybe if they can get Benjamin to come, then maybe Jacob will come too. I don't know. We don't know exactly what the plan is, but whatever it is, he wants to see the rest of his family, or at the very least, he wants to see his brother. And then he lets them sit in prison for a few days to mull it over. He gives them very harsh words, very harsh treatment, and then lets them stew on it for a little bit so that then he can come and give them some good news. Verse 18. Now, Joseph said to them on the third day, do this and live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers be confined in your prison. But as for the rest of you, go. Carry grain for the famine of your households, and bring your youngest brother to me, so your words may be verified, and you will not die. And they did so. Then they said to one another, truly, we are guilty concerning our brother, because we saw the distress of his soul when he pleaded with us, yet we would not listen. Therefore, this distress has come upon us. Reuben answered them, saying, did I not tell you, do not sin against the boy, and you would not listen? Now comes the reckoning for his blood. A few interesting things to point out here. First, there's Reuben's I told you so moment. I continue to lean towards him being more self-focused. Perhaps in this moment, though, he's starting to come around. You know, it's been 20 years. And perhaps he's wisened up a bit. Maybe he's legitimately sorrowful. But also, the most important reason this is significant is they definitely think he's dead. Or at least Reuben definitely thinks he's dead. Because they're saying he must be dead, and we know that God is a God of justice, and now God is bringing down the retribution upon us. And it's interesting, and this comes to the bigger point. This whole time, even though when they sold Joseph into slavery originally, no, they didn't care. They say that. They said he pled with us and we didn't listen. We didn't care. We hated him. And they come up with that plan to deceive their father, and then they try to comfort him when he's sorrowful. And then it seems they just go on with their lives after that, hoping that, all right, now it's over. But the guilt was always there. The guilt always remained. And when the moment from their perspective of reckoning comes, they realize, oh, we couldn't escape. We couldn't get away. They know who God is. They know what he expects. And the other reason I believe that they think he's dead is because we have, in Genesis 9:6, God gives a directive to Noah that's to be passed down to the rest of his descendants. God says, whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man. At this point, they're thinking, we're going to die. It's over. If we don't do what he says, or if something else bad happens, he's given us a way out, but if something else bad happens, it's over. We're done. Because God values life. He values human life. And I just want to ask you, have you resolved any of the bitterness that's been in your heart? When we first talked about Joseph and his brothers and we brought that up, we saw how devastating bitterness can be. If at that time you had any bitterness in your heart and you heard how devastating it is, how sinful it is, how vile it is, did you deal with it? Or are you still letting it fester? Or perhaps you didn't have any bitterness in your heart before, but now you do because of something that happened recently. Are you going to deal with it? Understand that the bitterness you have and any evil that you've done as a result of that bitterness, the guilt from that will never go away. And God doesn't want you to be bitter. He wants you to be loving. The message that Tom has been teaching could not be more perfectly in sync with the story of Joseph. We also get a glimpse of the opposite side of this. We get a glimpse into Joseph's heart, because when they say that to one another, we get to verse 23. They did not know, however, that Joseph understood, for there was an interpreter between them. He turned away from them and wept. See, one thing that Joseph has been wondering in these 20 years when he sees them is, who are these men now? They hated me before. They cared only about themselves before. Have they changed? Are they any different? What do they think about God? What do they think about his character and his statutes and what he requires? And he hears them say that to one another, saying, we've been found out. We're guilty. We shouldn't have done what we did. And Joseph is going, wow, that's different from who you were when I last saw you. And he's so overcome with emotion from that and that he's seen his family again, because it's been 20 years, that he weeps. But then, when he returned to them and spoke to them, he took Simeon from them and bound them before their eyes. Why does he take Simeon? Well, it doesn't tell us. There's a couple possibilities. One possibility could be that, well, Simeon and Levi were the ones who murdered the Shechemites. So perhaps Simeon's character was one of the most lesser repute. And so maybe he was the ringleader behind, you know, when they were trying to throw him into the pit. Maybe just overall he was not a great guy in comparison to the rest of the brothers. I don't know. And it also doesn't say, he tells them to choose somebody. So it's not clear if he chose them or if his brothers chose him or exactly what happened there. But whatever it is, he grabs Simeon. Then Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain and to restore every man's money in his sack and give them provisions for their journey. And thus it was done for them. So here's the other insight into seeing that Joseph does not harbor any bitterness when he could have. He doesn't seek retribution when he could have. Again, aside from Pharaoh, he's the most powerful man that he knows of. And these brothers who wanted him dead and figured, well, maybe let's not kill him. Let's just get some money off of him and sell him, and then he'll die at some point. He has the opportunity. I mean, he throws them in prison. He has the opportunity to do whatever he wants. Anything. He can do it. What would you do? What would you do if you were in a situation someone has horribly wronged you, or someone you care about? And you were given this opportunity. Hey, this person has wronged you. Here's the power to do whatever you want to them, if you want to do anything to them. What would you do? Would you take revenge? Or would you do what Joseph does, which is care for them? Love them. Provide for them as is appropriate. They were his family, so. Guys, this is a powerful picture, both of Joseph's character and also as a reminder to us that bitterness begets bitterness. The only way to break that is to stop, to repent of your own bitterness, and to show love instead. So, verse 26. So they loaded their donkeys with their grain and departed from there. As one of them opened his sack to give his donkey fodder at the lodging place, he saw his money. Behold, it was in the mouth of his sack. Then he said to his brothers, "My money has been returned. Behold, it is even in my sack." And their hearts sank. And they turned trembling to one another, saying, "What is this that God has done to us?" What's going on here? Well, they paid for the food. They paid for the grain. They brought money with them to pay for it all. And what Joseph does, secretly, without them knowing, is he gives them their food, and he's like, "Hey, here's the money they gave me." When they're not looking, put it in their sacks so that they basically get it for free. Family discount. That's what he's doing. And from their perspective, though, because they have no idea who this guy is, they're just like, "We just got accused of being spies. We got thrown in prison." Then finally he's like, "Okay, you can take this food now, but you'd better, if you come back, you'd better bring your younger brother," which I don't know why he cares so much about that, but that's, this guy is a loose cannon. And then they're like, "Our money is still here." Oh no. Why is that a no-no? Well, as far as they're concerned, if they go back, what are they going to be accused of? Theft. They gave the money and then somehow found a way to steal it back and get away with all of their food for free. And guys, I guess in this culture, we can tend to think of theft as one of the lesser evils when it comes to all the different crimes that are committed in this country. But understand, theft is very, very serious, especially in ancient times. And as far as they're concerned, if they go back, they might be dead. They might be killed, executed because of this, because they stole money from the second in command of Egypt, as far as they know. So they're terrified. They're going, what has God done to us? Because they know that he's the one in control of these things. Now, a bit of application. First, do not be deceived into expecting that you can survive long enough from having a sin found out. If you just survive and hang on long enough so that the heat comes off you, that then you'll be able to get away with it and you won't have to deal with the guilt. Sure, you may get away with it in this life, but you will one, never be free of the guilt, and the punishment will still come just at the end of your life. So instead, if there is any secret sin that you're holding on to, that you're trying to conceal from others, if there are any lies that you've told to try to build this elaborate structure that as long as nobody pries too hard, they won't find out, come clean. Just come clean. Guys, I can tell you from experience, holding on to lies is never worth it. That's how you are in deceiving others and trying to hold on to that, you are deceiving yourself as well, that it's not, that it'll be better for you to lie than to tell the truth. And why do we hold on to the lie? Why did Jacob's brothers hold on to the lie? Well, Joseph's brothers hold on to the lie. Well, they didn't want to experience the consequences. They didn't want to have to face those consequences, and so they lied to try to prevent those consequences from happening. But it's a short-term gain for a long-term severe loss. Guys, it'll just get worse and worse and worse, and you'll feel that because you've been lying for so long, if you come clean now, the consequence that you feared then, oh, it's going to be even worse now. Yeah, probably. But if you just keep holding on to it, and it gets worse and worse and worse and worse and worse and worse and worse, well, one, you should probably be considering where your eternal soul is at. The consequence will be so severe that it turns out you're not a Christian, and you're going to face eternal punishment in hell. But also know that the consequences that you suffer, what you must recognize is that that's just, that's justice. That's right. That's good. It is good for sin to be punished. It is good for consequences to come for sin. And if you come clean and you repent, then you're free. And you can, from that point forward, move on to serve God in righteousness. Don't hold on to it. Holding on to lies is never worth it. So that's Joseph's deposition. Then finally we come to Jacob's unrelenting sorrow. Verse 29. When they came to their father, Jacob, in the land of Canaan, they told him all that had happened to them, saying, "The man, the lord of the land, spoke harshly with us and took us for spies of the country. But we said to him, 'We are honest men. We are not spies. We are 12 brothers, sons of our father. One is no longer alive, and the youngest is with our father today in the land of Canaan.' The man, the lord of the land, said to us, 'By this I will know that you are honest men. Leave one of your brothers with me, and take grain for the famine of your households, and go. But bring your youngest brother to me, that I may know that you are not spies, but honest men. I will give your brother to you, and you may trade in the land.' Now it came about as they were emptying their sacks, that behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when they and their father saw their bundles of money, they were dismayed. Their father Jacob said to them, 'You have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more.'" From this view, he's convinced, well, they probably think we stole the money, so they just killed Simeon. He's as good as dead. "And you would take Benjamin. All these things are against me. Then Reuben spoke to his father, saying, "You may put my two sons to death if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my care, and I will return him to you." But Jacob said, "My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he alone is left. If harm should befall him on the journey you are taking, then you will bring my gray hair down to Sheol in sorrow." Jacob saying, "Look, I'm 129 years old." We're going to find out when Pharaoh speaks to Jacob when they eventually do come to Egypt. Pharaoh asks him how old he is, and he says, "I'm 130," and this is a year before that, probably. So right now he's 129. He's like, "Look, if I experience any more grief or sorrow, I'm going to die." Like, that's what's going on here. "You can't take my son. You cannot take him. Please, just, we have the food that we have, and let's just cut our losses, and that's it. We're done. Do not go back." Because as far as he's concerned, they'll be accused of theft. They've already killed one. They could kill more. Just no. So eventually they'll be waiting another year, because when we get to that point, Joseph tells his brothers, "Hey, we're 2 years into the 7-year famine. There's 5 years left. So we're going to have to wait a whole another year." And why does God do this delay? Why does God work in such a way where Jacob is like, "No, you're not doing that. You're not going back to Egypt. Stay here." Why does God do that? Well, I believe it gives Joseph time to plan. Because consider, Joseph was not expecting, I don't think, he was expecting his brothers to show up. Then they do, and he's like, "Oh my gosh, it all makes sense. This is why I'm here. This is what God has prepared me for." And then he's got to figure out what to do with his brothers and make sure to find a way for them to come back. And he's like, "Okay, all right, go. They're gone. They've got the food. Families are taken care of. All right, now how am I going to get them back? How am I going to get all of them to come here? And how do I make sure that all the livestock is taken care of? Because this is an agricultural society, not a, you know, pasturing livestock society. So what am I going to do?" And he starts planning. Is what I'm convinced is going to happen, because he has a very elaborate plan that he tells them once he finally reveals himself to them. But regardless of exactly why, there's one other thing that Joseph is doing here that we'll see played out in the next chapters. Joseph does intend to give his brothers a test as to whether they have changed since he last saw them, whether they've truly changed. He got some inkling that maybe they've changed, but he wants to know if they've truly changed. Do they see Benjamin in the same way that they saw him before? Do they see him and hate him as the next favored child? Or do they view him differently? Have they changed their ways? He's going to give them a test when they return. But we'll see the outcome of that in the following week. So, to close, Joseph could have used his power and influence to make his brothers suffer. But he didn't. Instead, and also, perhaps he could have been in a moment where he gets all this power, and perhaps he was tempted to think, maybe if my brothers do come, if he had been bitter against them, he would have been biding his time, planning for the perfect moment. And we can sometimes want to do that too. If we want to get back at somebody, well, usually we don't respond right away. Usually we'll wait. We'll bide our time, waiting for the perfect moment. Make sure it has perfect timing, maximum impact. But guys, instead of planning for ways in which you can perfectly time the, you know, exacting your own revenge, instead, trust in God's perfect timing. Because God perfectly timed all of these circumstances to bring Joseph to where exactly he needed to be. He'd been preparing him and nurturing him this entire time to grow into a responsible, righteous, godly man who would save his family. Guys, who knows what God's planning for you? Who knows what he's preparing you for now? So instead of focusing on your own desires, your own intentions, think of how God, one, is using you now. Why are you where you are in this state of life right now? Why do you have the friends that you have? Why are you interacting with the people that you're interacting with? Why are you at this school or not at that school? Why are you in this ministry opportunity, and or why aren't you in this ministry opportunity? Why are you where you are? God has perfect timing. And both in these moments now, where most likely you're just being prepared, and in moments in the future when you realize, oh, this is what it was for. This is what God has been building me towards. Pursue that. Look forward to that instead. Instead of taking matters into your own hands or living your life for yourself, what are you doing to be the most prepared you could be so that in any given moment when the time is right, you are ready to serve God? Let's pray. Dear Lord, thank you for this time that we can see how you brought everything together, and Joseph saw it. He realized he'd experienced all of that suffering, all of that likely loneliness, all of this strange new land, so that he might be given a position to save his family, to save the lineage of Abraham, to save Judah, to save the line of descendants that would lead toward the Messiah. Lord, might we be encouraged by this, trusting that any circumstance that we are in, whether suffering, whether sorrowful, whether joyful, you have perfect timing. Every circumstance we experience is for our good if we are in you. Encourage us with that, and might we go out living in light of it. In your name, amen.